VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the game World Cup Daily from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer and thank you for joining us. We are here every match day of the World Cup, podcasting after 10 o'clock UK time every night. It is knockout football from this point on, no second chances in the last 16. It's been another wonderful day of entertainment and a great day for Paris Saint-Germain strikers, but not such a good day for Messi and Ronaldo. In the studio with me, casting his eye over all the entertainment, Giles Smith. Hi, Giles.
Hi, Natalie.
Later on, we'll be speaking to Oliver Kay for reaction to Uruguay's 2-1 victory over Portugal. Plus, we'll be discussing the latest from the England camp ahead of their last 16 clash with Colombia on Tuesday night. But first, we go to Alison Rudd in Kazan, who witnessed a 7-goal thriller as France overcame Argentina 4-3 to reach the quarterfinals. And Alison, France's talented forwards weren't that impressive in the group stage, but today it was all about Kylian Mbappe with those 2 goals, as well as winning a penalty at just 19 years old as well. It was some way for him to announce himself on the biggest stage in world football, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he's such a modest guy with it. He came into the press conference because if you're named as man of the match, you have to do a quick media performance in front of the assembled press. And he was sort of asked silly questions about his birth being as important as France winning the cup in the World Cup in 1998, because he was born in 1998. And so he handled it very well. And also his manager did, you know, there were lots of comparisons with the greats. They're saying, isn't he just like the Brazilian Ronaldo? And Deschamps played it down because the last thing he wants now is for the pressure to be piled on a youngster. As you say, he's just 19. At this stage of the competition, he needs him. And if I've seen France's 3 games prior to this, and he's been adjusting to Russia. He's been adjusting to the different systems that Deschamps has been playing. He's adjusting also to the fact that when there's been meddling with the formation and speculation about it, it's been because of him, really. How do we get the best out of Mbappe? And that, at that age, to have that sort of pressure where, you know, people are having to rejig things and players are getting dropped and then brought back in because they want to get the best out of you, must be quite difficult to handle. But it all came to fruition today, and I saw, you know, on social media a lot of people were slating Giroud, you know, the invisible man, someone called him, and I forgot he was playing. But just him being there, I think, is enormously important. A, because he's got that maturity and father figure like attitude towards Mbappe. And he sort of just holds the front line together and just gives them a pattern and a sense of where people know where to run to. He's like a sort of one of those chaps at the airport, the guy the plane's in, really. I think he's important in a sort of understated sort of way. But yeah, it was a privilege to see it live, Natalie.
Yeah, I bet. And not wanting to put more pressure on Mbappe, he does, of course, become the first teenager to score twice in a World Cup match since Pelé in 1958. We all know what happened with Pelé. But for him to become a better talent, does he need to move out of the French league, perhaps come to, I don't know, the Premier League or go to La Liga?
Well, there was, if you recall, when he sort of starred for Monaco when they won their first title for 17 years, and he shone also in the Champions League. And basically, he could name his club as long as it had enough money. It was up to him where he'd go, and there was speculation. People were saying, oh, I think he really liked Real Madrid when he was little, so maybe he'll go to Real Madrid. And so on. And then some people were saying, oh, well, he shouldn't move at all because he's so young, and that would be ridiculous. He should just hang on and make sure he learns who he is, and without the pressure of a huge price tag on him. And I think he did the compromise thing, which is he stayed in France but moved to a big club. So he's getting, the best of both worlds. He's getting experience alongside some very fine players indeed. He's getting experience at a club that has high expectations, but he hasn't left home. He's still, you know, he was born in Paris, and he played his youth football in Paris. It's home for him. So I think I don't think he's wasted in France. I think in 5 years' time he could be anywhere, and probably then would be the time to say, did he plot his career correctly? But I think no. I think it's easy with hindsight to say, oh, he's just starred in one of the best World Cup games you're going to see. So why isn't he playing for Manchester United? It's not all about that. It's about just progressing your career properly.
Giles, it is, 20 years to the day that Michael Owen scored that famous goal against Argentina. There was more than a hint of Owen as Mbappe raced at the Argentina defence before being hauled down by Marcos Rojo.
Yeah, it's just one of those sort of moments in a match that kind of sets it on fire. And no coincidence, I think, that those things that you often see from very young players, because they're kind of an expression of youthfulness, really. You know, just tearing through, taking a defence apart, taking half the midfield with you as well, if necessary. And really coming from players who are just young enough that they haven't really learned yet. You kind of feel to fear for their shins, for one thing, and for a second point, that they aren't looking to win a free kick halfway through the journey. You know, it's like an expression of youth.
Which is a nice thing to have, isn't it? Have that youth behind you. But Alison, you mentioned how much of a privilege it was to watch Mbappe today. You were also lucky enough to witness some spectacular goals, perhaps two best goals of the tournament so far.
Yeah, there was, you know, if you do this job long enough, you see the same old people, and occasionally they hit an age where the journalists say, I don't know if I'm just getting a bit jaded. I don't know if I really get as much joy out of football as I did. And to a man and woman, when those goals went in, everyone went, oh! It was just like being a child again. It was astonishing. It had everything, really. Every sort of goal. And one of the small elements of what made it a great game was there was always hope for Argentina. You know, there was hope because, although they weren't playing well and they were giving too much space to France, I mean, they're pushing up and pushing up, you did feel something else, either magical or freaky, would happen.
Unfortunately, though, it is the end of the road for Argentina, Giles. And presumably the end of Diego Maradona on our television screens?
Well, unless he stays on, who knows? But we're definitely going to miss him. I reckon you could say that this is the World Cup where Maradona has made his biggest impact since 1986, really, in the hand of God. He's so visible on the screens with the celebrating and more particularly the despair. People say it's boring in the corporate areas, but clearly not when he's sitting in them. Something a bit stronger than prawn sandwiches seems to have been going down. But there's a direct connection, I think, as well, between these shots we've been seeing of Maradona this time and those shots of him charging wide-eyed at the cameras after scoring at USA 94, after which he then failed a random drug test a couple of hours later. But it's the same wide-eyed look. Apparently FIFA are paying him several thousand dollars a day to be there as an ambassador. And if that's the case, then they've more than got their money's worth.
Oh, we've enjoyed seeing him, that's for sure. By the time, of course, you're listening to this, Jorge Sampaoli may have already been sacked as the Argentina manager. He had to deny this week that Lionel Messi was running the team. He'd been in charge for, just over a year, Sampaoli. And this is a man that Gab Marcotti described as a genius on this podcast before the start of the tournament. Alison, where do you think it all went wrong for Argentina?
Well, they haven't got a balanced team. And they are, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche to say it, and I like to be contrary, but I have to follow the party line, if you like. And it does seem that Messi ran the show, not the manager, and that is always a recipe for disaster. It's a self-perpetuating thing. It's not entirely his fault. Sampaoli's fault. It's because if you sit in a Sampaoli press conference, it is a very strange thing indeed, because every single question is about Lionel Messi. Even if in a roundabout way it's a question about the weather, it ends up being, is it the sort of weather that Messi will like? It doesn't matter what the question is, it ends up being what will make Messi happy. And the manager buys into that. He doesn't stop the narrative. He will add at the end of every sentence, we have lots of other players as well. He doesn't really name them or anything. I mean, it's sort of farcical slightly that it's a team that can only function if one player is emotionally robust, if one player is able to express himself, if one player is able to feel he has authority. That's not healthy. It's just not healthy. And, maybe it's an impossible job. I mean, there have been plenty of managers who haven't lasted too long before him, so that's a job you can say no to if you're a patriot.
Well, lastly, Alison, I mean, the biggest question does surround Messi himself. He'll be, what, 35, almost 35 in 4 years' time? So do you think there's a chance that he might retire from international football now?
Well, Mascherano just retired. Wouldn't surprise me if Messi retired and then came back again and then retired again.
He likes doing
that. That's my prediction, because he's done it before. And he'll be so upset he'll do it again. And then his country will say, no, we need you. And there'll be a new manager, so he'll think maybe this is the start of something new. But it wouldn't surprise me if he does resign, if it's not permanent. Retire. Players don't resign. Maybe he's different. He's not like a normal player. He doesn't retire. He resigns.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Game, World Cup Daily from The Times with Natalie Sawyer.
You can hear live commentary of all of Sunday's games from the round of 16 on TalkSport. It starts with Spain taking on Russia at 3 o'clock. Then the clash between Croatia and Denmark is live at 7 on TalkSport. We are days away now from England taking on Colombia in the last 16. Oliver Kay joins us now from Russia. And ahead of that clash, Gareth Southgate says he was uncomfortable with the love-in after the first two group games. And he has attracted some criticism for his team selection against Belgium. Ollie, has that been fair?
I didn't have a problem with it. I know a lot of people did have a problem with it. But they qualified for the next stage. You want to sort of manage the squad as carefully as you can. It's not about hoping to lose or about hoping to finish second so you get an easier route. We can debate the sort of pros and cons of that. But I thought in terms of managing the squad, he knows which players need a rest. He knows which players need a game. And I didn't have a problem with that at all. I didn't have a problem with it when Roy Hodgson did it against Slovakia in Euro 2016. And that resulted in a game against Iceland, and we all know how that went. But it's not really about what you do in those games when the pressure's not on. It's about what you do when the pressure's on, and the pressure's on against Colombia on Tuesday, and I think that is where people should judge England. I wouldn't really fret about Thursday at all, and I know some who do and talk about momentum, but it didn't bother me at all.
It was always going to be a case of damned if you do, damned if you don't, I suppose, for Gareth Southgate in England. But Tuesday's game, it is, of course, a knockout. That means the dreaded possibility of penalties. Jonathan Northcroft has written about England and shootouts and the fact that Southgate has insisted on a sports psychologist to help deal with stress. Is it as simple as that, Ollie? Is it purely psychological when it comes to these shootouts?
I think it's a technical issue as well. I think you have to realise that taking a penalty is not the same as just being a good player. I think There'll be many great players who haven't been very good at penalties or at penalty shootout situations. I think there've been very many players who haven't been great players who have been good at penalty situations. And I think, what slightly bothers me is that we get so hung up in the media on penalties. I think if you look at the last five tournaments, I mean, obviously there was a stage, I'm thinking 1990, 96, 98, 2004, 2006, all penalty shootouts, yes? Mm-hmm. And then you look at, since then, 2008, didn't qualify, 2010, pounded 4-1 in the second round by Germany. 2012, yes, penalties, having been completely outplayed. 2014, didn't get out of the group. 2016, beaten by Iceland. 2018, well, we don't know yet, and it could be penalties. But I think the way we talk about penalties, you'd be forgiven for thinking that England are beaten on penalties every time. And it's just not the case. I think we need to get the basics right. We need to perform, seize the moment, not completely collapse when things go wrong like they did against Iceland 2 years ago. I think they just need to perform and show the mentality to win a game and the qualities to win a game in the knockout stages. And that bothers me more than penalties. I sometimes feel that the obsession with penalties, which is a media obsession, then becomes a sort of self-perpetuating obsession for the players themselves.
Thing is, we are obsessed with penalty shootouts. So, Giles, is it the ultimate sporting drama?
Well, I think obviously it's a lottery and a farce and a terrible way to end a football match unless your team wins, in which case, then yes, it's the ultimate sporting drama. Very little to match the intensity of watching your team win a penalty shootout. And of course, very little to match the misery of watching your team lose one. But I think I'd always rather watch a penalty shootout on the telly than in the ground. In some ways, there's something about, I suppose at least you've got a sofa to hide behind.
Well, I was going to say, I'd be running away. So,
yeah, and yeah. Cushions to bury your head in. Yeah. One thinks of David Batty at France 98 and ITV's Brian Moore saying to Kevin Keegan, Brian Moore was commentating, the late Brian Moore was commentating, he said to Kevin Keegan, quickly, Kevin, will he score? Which, of course, the worst hospital pass in the history of football broadcasting, because Keegan was hardly going to say no, he's not going to score. He said he would, and of course, Batty missed, and the rest is miserable old history. They do make for great televisual drama, definitely.
Dele Alli, Ollie's been speaking to the media today, and he said, with regards to a penalty shootout, if I'm on the pitch, I'll take one, which is obviously good to hear. But how important is it simply to have Alli back?
Well, I think it's really important. I know they beat Panama 6-1 without him, but it was only Panama, and I know people took umbrage at that statement at the time. I think people were slightly giddy at the time, some people, and were taking exception to any sense of lads, it was Panama, but it was Panama, and they were awful. England scored 5 times in the first half. Ruben Loftus-Cheek showed that he is a talented young player, a very promising young player. But I would be much happier playing Dele Alli in a knockout game against Colombia. I would still even have doubts about Dele Alli in terms of mentality, in terms of doing it in a game like this, and whether he's ready for that kind of pressure, whether he's ready for this kind of stage. But I would say that about a whole lot of them, really. I mean, it's a young team. Let's see whether they're ready. Let's see whether they're ready to show the mentality to win it. I really hope they do. But it's early for a lot of these players. So let's see.
Paul Joyce has written for The Times about Jordan Henderson and how influential he's been in Russia so far, specifically the role that he plays in organising his teammates and giving out orders. How much of a leader is Henderson for you, Ollie?
I think he's extremely good at that, and I've watched him a lot at Liverpool over the last, the 7 years he's been there, and I think he's grown a lot as a player, he's grown a lot as a personality within that team. I think he is the best player England have in terms of setting that rhythm in midfield. I would worry slightly that England's midfield might be overrun because they don't have too much defensive nous in there. But he is a guy who knows how to pass it at different times of the game, depending on whether his team's on top or not. He's a clever player. He's got that leadership quality. I think he is very important for England.
Well, England and the fans will be hoping they are smiling come Tuesday night. And Giles, you're sort of intrigued by the way fans have been celebrating both here and in Russia.
We're seeing a lot of beer chucked in the air at England goals.
What a waste.
I mean, that's not a what a waste. I know that's not a completely new thing, but it does seem to have slightly come of age at this tournament. There's some shots from fan zones and bars of everybody chucking their pint in the air as a goal goes in, and of course poor old Gabby Logan covering it for the BBC got drenched. It just seems to be a funny moment for it to come of age, because of course the possibility of a VAR review means that you could chuck your beer up as the goal goes in, and then of course the ref calls it back and the goal hasn't stood, and then you're out of ammo for when the real goal happens. But we're seeing a lot of it, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not sure. It's definitely a waste of beer, as you say.
Yes. Have you been soaked yet then by beer, Ollie?
It's very hard. It's very hard to soak someone in beer when they're in a press box, because it's right at the back of the stand generally, and to do that you'd have to have a beer and chuck it backwards. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners and probably a lot of people in general would have a view of the press that they deserve to have beer chucked at them and with great force and perhaps with perhaps recycled beer at that. But it's like it was an Oasis gig in 1996. But it's but no, don't waste a drink.
The Game. World Cup Daily from The Times with Natalie Sawyer.
We'll be giving you a Times trivia teaser question every day on every podcast, as provided by Times statistician Bill Edgar. Last time out, we asked you, at which World Cup were three of the four quarterfinals decided by penalty shootouts? The answer was 1986. France beat Brazil, West Germany beat Mexico, and Belgium beat Spain, all via penalty shootout. The only match not settled by penalties was England's 2-1 defeat to Diego Maradona's Argentina. I don't know if you can remember that one. Our teaser today is a double header. The 2002 World Cup was held in two countries. Which country staged the opening game and which country hosted the final? Tune into our next podcast to find out the answer. There was another enthralling last 16 tie in Sochi as Uruguay hung on to beat Portugal 2-1 thanks to a double from Edison Cavani. And Ollie, Uruguay are many people's dark horses for the tournament, and they now have a major scalp in beating the European champions Portugal and progressing to the last eight.
They've come into form well. They're very efficient going forward. They're extremely sort of dogged in the middle of the park. They defend brilliantly with Godin and Jimenez, and it's they look like a team who could or will reach semi-final. I mean, they reached semi-final back in 2010, and I think they look like a really competitive, dogged team that are very good at this sort of knockout football.
We now know it's going to be France against Uruguay and Nizhny Novgorod in the quarterfinals on Friday afternoon. We've seen how devastating France can be going forward, but also how, and as you've already said, dogged defensively Uruguay are. It's going to be a fascinating encounter, isn't it?
Yeah, it really should be. I mean, I'm going to be there on Friday, and I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I think the way it was originally billed is it could be Portugal Argentina. It could be Ronaldo versus Messi. But I think France Uruguay will be a terrific game. I mean, I think both teams have done well so far in the tournament without particularly setting a light, without particularly setting their pulse racing or winning too many hearts until France today. But I think that will be a really good game on Friday. I would expect France to be maybe to take the initiative in the game or try to take the initiative in the game, but they won't be taking too many risks. They won't be sending their fullbacks bombing forward, and maybe it'll be a little bit cagier than we saw from either team today.
It was a fantastic first goal for Uruguay. Edison Cavani and Luis Suarez with the longest 1-2 ever. Cavani, cross-field ball to Suarez, who then whipped the ball into Cavani, who scored with his face, we think. A very handsome face, Charles, would you say?
Yeah, I always think that Cavani looks like he's broken loose from a Greek frieze or something. It's like a, like a kind of human Elgin marble. It's a very handsome face, but it's good to see him risking it at the far post. Presumably it's insured. That's the other thing about Cavani. When he's not doing anything, you wonder if he's just a handsome face. But then you see him today and realise that actually what a striker he is as well.
Yeah, there's more to him than just that handsome face, basically, Giles.
But
Cavani hadn't scored in the first two games. He cut a very frustrated figure in the third game against Russia, but did eventually score late on. Two goals tonight, and it just shows how important it is for strikers to get off the mark, doesn't it, Ollie?
It does, and when we talk about strikers and how well they do in tournaments, just one that springs to mind here is Gary Lineker back in 1986, and he had a slow start to that tournament, didn't score the first two games. England didn't score those first two games, and then the goals started flowing. He scored a hat-trick in the third game, and goals started flowing. Go to, you know, look at Paolo Rossi in 1982. I think he didn't score till the knockout stage, and then the goals come. And sometimes, you know, it's about hitting form at the right time, about peaking at the right time. And it's a very strange thing with footballers and World Cups, because they're not really conditioned to sort of peak performance-wise in late June, early July. But Cavani, after a slow start to the competition, seems to have found his rhythm at last. You wouldn't bet against him, being one of the stars of the tournament.
By contrast, Cristiano Ronaldo, yet to score in a World Cup knockout game. And he's going to have to wait another 4 years, Giles.
Yep, it all went a bit flat, didn't it? It started so promisingly for him, and everyone thought this was going to be the Cristiano Ronaldo tournament. And then it went away. But I don't know what to say. Maybe we have to blame the goatee. I can't think of anything else. He was really fantastic in that opening game. And then the goatee began to sprout, and it all went awry. There's a lesson there, maybe.
Maybe. Don't have the fluff, perhaps. But, Ollie, how do you assess Cristiano Ronaldo's tournament?
I was there in Sochi for that first game where he scored a hat-trick against Spain. And I thought if you looked at that game, I mean, it wasn't one where you were left praising his creative or technical brilliance throughout the game. I think he was... What that game said to me is that he is a player who is capable of seizing the occasion, seizing his opportunities within the game. I mean, it was a penalty. It was then a sort of mishit shot, which De Gea fumbled in, and then it was that incredible free kick. He didn't do an awful lot in open play that made you think that he was ready to dominate the tournament or anything like that. But I think there are lots of people who like to think that it's a competition between Messi and Ronaldo to be the greatest player ever, and that it can only be decided in a World Cup. And I think what today shows is that you can't decide these things on a World Cup. It's very hard to do in those games what they do for Real Madrid and Barcelona. And I feel that they are both past their best and yet both enduring brilliantly. They still are capable of utterly brilliant things that are beyond the grasp of any other players on the planet. But those games today showed that trying to carry the hopes of a national team in a World Cup is an incredibly pressurised situation at the best of times, never mind when those teams are not top class.
4 more teams enter the knockout stage on Sunday. First up, it is Spain, who take on Russia in the Luzhniki Stadium. Spain have yet to hit top gear, but they'll be aiming to do just that against the hosts, who will hope they're spurred on by the home fans in Moscow. And then it'll be Croatia and Denmark's turn to see who will progress to the quarterfinals to face either Spain or Russia. Croatia have impressed so far at this World Cup, topping their group by winning all of their 3 games and conceding just once. Denmark themselves are also unbeaten from the group stage and are looking to reach the World Cup quarterfinals for only the second time in their history. England will be looking to reach the quarterfinals for the World Cup for the first time since 2006. There was a lot of debate about how England should have approached their game with Belgium on Thursday. And interestingly, Giles, you kept an eye on the game in a slightly different way to most.
Yes, I watched on Sky Sports News. which obviously they don't have any pictures of the World Cup on Sky Sports News, but they are covering it as thoroughly as they cover everything else. I was just intrigued because there was that fantastic moment in the European Championships last time out in France when England were playing Iceland, and Sky Sports News covered it as they always do. They have someone in the studio watching it on the telly telling you about it. On that occasion, they got Steve McLaren in, and there was just this wonderful moment. England had just equalised, and Steve McLaren went into a long sentence about how this was just great, England were going to recover from here. And in the middle of that sentence, of course, Iceland scored again. And it's just the most beautiful crestfallen look that Steve McLaren gives. You could see just how much it really meant to him that this thing had gone wrong in front of his eyes. And it was a very hapless moment for him. And I suppose I was rather cheekily hoping to see something as kind of classic, a piece of TV gold to match that. Didn't, in fact. They had Stephen Warnock on, the Liverpool player. And again, watching it on a screen. Meanwhile, lots of coverage of the other big news stories. It was a very strange sensation to be watching it and to know that everybody else was seeing the pictures.
But it's not weird watching someone watching a game, basically.
Yes, it is weird. But of course, it's something that we've just become kind of inured to because of Soccer Saturday, which is just a sort of brilliant piece of television. I mean, extraordinary. If you said to people, we're going to sit a bunch of people down and you're going to watch them watch football on the telly. But of course, Soccer Saturday turns out to be amazingly prescient. It predicts Gogglebox, which again is another programme in which basically you're watching people watch it. There is something fundamentally entertaining, clearly, about watching people watching telly.
We always have to have a little chat, don't we, about the pundits being used on BBC and ITV, and one that continues to stand out in an obvious way, Giles, is Ian Wright.
He's just been absolutely on fire. I mean, some of the shirts have looked as if they were literally on fire. It's just been a romp through his wardrobe from the beginning of the tournament onwards. Every single match he seems to find some new shirt to delight us with. But I'm hearing that he does a bit of punditry duty for Fox.
Yes, he moonlights for them, yeah.
He moonlights for Fox. And apparently on Fox he's not wearing the... he appears... It's a bit like Clark Kent and Superman. He appears in a completely sort of sober outfit for Fox and only does the bright shirt thing for ITV. He must be responding to the studio, I guess. The studio kind of accepts and demands maybe even a bright coloured shirt.
Yeah, maybe for Fox he is Ian Wright and ITV he's Wrighty.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Jürgen Klinsmann made his first appearance of this World Cup on the BBC today. He's an old favourite that's returned, isn't he?
Yes, he did. The lineup on the BBC was Klinsmann next to Drogba, Shearer and Lineker, which, you know, you'd have to say was a bit heavy up top maybe, but that's quite a striking partnership they've got there. Klinsmann's been part of BBC World Cups for ages now, except for the 1 year, you know, 2006, when he was doing the much less important job of managing Germany. But it's interesting, presumably they brought him in at this stage just as the knockouts start because they thought this would be the time we'd all value a German perspective on what was happening. Of course, it just so happens that they're out. Guess what? We don't need a German perspective particularly. But good to have him on. I'm sure he'll have things to say about other people too.
Yes, and the England-Columbia game is on ITV, and there's some troubling stats for England fans on that front, isn't there?
Yes, well, apparently, if you go back to 1996 and take all of the tournament games that England have played on television, when they've been on ITV, England have a win rate of 26.08%.
Oh, no.
When they've been on the BBC, they have a win rate of 62.5%. Which is obviously considerably better. So the Columbia game is indeed on ITV. No pressure, Mark Pugach.
I was going to say, if I wasn't nervous as much as I am already, I'm now going to be even more nervous knowing that it's on ITV and England have such a poor win rate when it's shown on ITV. Oh, fingers crossed for an England win, though. That is it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Giles Smith, Oliver Kay and Alison Rudd. Subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. If you're listening on Sunday, today is the last chance to subscribe for just £1 a month for 3 months as the digital subscription sale ends at midnight tonight. Search for the Times Sale for more information. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast supplier. And we'll be back on Sunday night in the company of Matt Dickinson and Jonathan Northcroft. We'll see you then.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.